layoffs in Kokomo and a ripple effect of the auto workers' strike, a teacher pay dispute in Richmond that could have wider implications, plus suburban indie lawmakers leaving their seats, and more. From the television studios at WFYI, it's Indiana Week in Review for the week ending October 20th, 2023.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.
This week, Stellantis, the parent company of Jeep and Chrysler, is temporarily laying off more workers across two plants in Kokomo. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Adam Yaher-Reyes reports the layoffs come as the United Auto Workers Union is in its fifth week on strike at a Stellantis assembly plant in Toledo, Ohio.
The two Kokomo plants produce castings and transmissions, many of which are used to make Jeeps in the Toledo assembly plant. A week after the strike began, Stellantis announced 300 of those plant's workers would be temporarily laid off. Without the assembly using the parts built in Kokomo, the company says it had to reduce production due to storage constraints. The company says it's still facing the same issue now, leading to additional temporary layoffs at both plants to avoid making parts that have nowhere to go. As of Friday, about 830 people have been taken off the Kokomo production lines. They will likely return to work once the strike ends. In past statements, the UAW called strike-related layoffs at Stellantis, Ford, and General Motors a choice and an attempt to squeeze members to, quote, settle for less.
Is the UAW using an effective strike strategy? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat, Terry Austin. Republican, Mike O'Brien. John Schwanis, host of Indiana Lawmakers. And Nikki Kelly, editor-in-chief of the Indiana Capital Chronicle. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House Bureau Chief Brandon Smith. Mike O'Brien, this is a very different strike strategy than we've seen from auto workers in the past, where instead of saying, okay, we're all going on strike everywhere, it's picking and choosing your spots at different plants, trying to, like, go where they don't think you're going to go and keep them on their toes. And we saw them, they won, a GM agreed to unionize the battery plants, and so that week they said, we're not going to strike in more places as a kind of like carrot stick approach almost. Sure. Is it effective?
So it certainly allows you to strike for a longer period of time. The old model of we're all going on strike, see on the picket line. Okay, well, that's fine because the that worked for a long time, but the underlying strategy that is the same, even though we have new tactics, is who blinks first? Who runs out of money first? At what point do the union workers go, hey, we're out of money at home. Like, I need you, like, we need to wrap this up. Like, just take a deal, whatever they're offering.
And I should so far, the union, this is relevant to the folks here in Kokomo, you're not eligible in Indiana for unemployment pay if you get laid off related to a strike of your union.
Right.
And so the union has been paying, like, it's $500
a week,
which is basically what you would get in unemployment benefits. So.
Right, but not what you're getting at $32 an hour when you're working in the,
no,
in
of course
the plant,
not.
Right?
And that money will run out at some point.
So is the strategy working? Again, it allows you to do this longer. If you're just rolling regionally, and so maybe some people are going back to work or they're trying to target high-margin facilities where they make, you know, pickup trucks, you know, or they make parts for those things. It allows you to do that because you're not inflicting that kind of economic pain on the entire union, on all 150,000 UAW workers. So it lets you do that. What's the politics of this are fascinating to me because Biden gets to kind of play it both ways. On one hand, he's got these proactive strategies and billions of dollars to states that are incentivizing them to move to green energy, to move to electric cars, to move to battery production. The UAW is looking down the line going, oh, we don't need that many workers anymore. Yeah. But then he's on the picket line. And so it's just this, it's all of this is connected. We talked about that a couple weeks ago, how the environmental and the economic are connected in this. But politically, he kind of gets to have it both ways, which, you know, who'd want to do that?
Yeah. Talking about the strike strategy, the benefit, it seems, from the strike strategy of the past, where we're all going out, is incredible visibility. But it also had the ripple effect across those communities, far beyond just the plants themselves, because in so many of these places, those plants are the heart of those communities, the economy. So in this sense, it doesn't feel as visible. It's not, I don't think as many people are noticing or paying attention to the fact that this strike is going on, but you don't have the same sort of immediate economic impact in a lot of those communities beyond just the plants themselves. So I'll ask you the same question. Is this an effective strike strategy?
I think it is. And, you know, Mike alluded to the fact that it's sort of whoever blinks first. But more importantly, this helps keep the members, one, working as long as possible. And they're strategic about where they're trying to strike. It helps save union resources so that they can pay their members longer. And I think people, the union is cognizant of, you know, the only two people or the only people that really matters, whether they're really paying attention or not, are the negotiators and the union for the big three. And when they're at the table, that the pressure will be felt, I believe. I think Sean Fain is doing a great job with this, quite honestly. But a strike is difficult all the way around for everybody. It is.
Kokomo, Indiana's own Sean Fain. But what struck me early on in this process was, this is they said from the beginning, this is our strategy. They started striking in various targeted places. And then they held off. We as I mentioned, you know, they had the GM plant or the GM concession about battery plants and unionizing workers there. And so they said, okay, we're going to hold off on strikes this week. But now we haven't seen a lot of new ones announced. They're saying instead of announcing weekly, it could come at any day, at any moment. Is it?
Yeah,
how do you view that?
In the beginning, it was a little better. It was sort of rolling and gaining momentum. It just seems to have sort of floundered right now. I mean, we're not seeing any addition, but we're also not seeing any progress really made in the negotiations.
At least none publicly that we know about.
Right. But so I think in the beginning it was sort of working, but I'm wondering as we're going on whether they're going to have to make the hard decision about, you know, is this worth all of us, you know, going to the picket line and not just a few. And by the way, I feel bad for the people who happen to be in the strategic plants, right? They've been off while a lot of their brethren are still getting to work and bring money home to their families. So there is a little bit of unfairness within the union once you do it this strategy, because not everyone is feeling the pain.
That's the other thing I wanted to talk about, and I'll ask you about that, John, which is the idea of it used to be, okay, we're all going on strike, or we're all not quite striking yet. And here you have folks who have been on strike for weeks and other folks who are still in their jobs. And there is a monetary difference in what you're getting because of that, as much as the union is trying to help. Does that create a potential problem long term for the union?
It may. And there's something ironic about the scenario you describe, in that one of the real sticking points for the unions is the notion of tiered pay for employees, that those who are employed for 10 years, I don't know the particular time thresholds, but somebody
eight.
Who is a...
Eight gets you to the cap.
Eight gets you to a cap, and that pays more than somebody who's been there half that time or one quarter that time. So essentially, they were battling... one of their primary thrusts here is to make sure everybody is treated equally. So there's a bit of irony there. As far as the notion of diminished visibility, I think we can all agree it has been diminished, but that may be due to factors beyond the control of the union. I mean, we are dealing with several other stories, and there's only so much oxygen in the room, to use the cliche, and news media attention certainly gets carved up. Other things are prioritized, crises overseas,
crises. Congress doesn't have
there are some other issues.
There's no one to intervene.
It's, it's like when you want to get attention, you always put out a news release if you're in PR on a day when you think nothing's happening. And if you want have a strike, you want to make sure you're having a maximum impact in terms of the impact and how this is hurting your employees and why they're doing what they're doing, as painful though it may be. And if other things are going on, it's hard to break through.
Time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question. And this week's question is, do you support the UAW strike against Ford, GM, and Stellantis? A, yes, or B, no. Last week we asked you whether the announcement of a second electric vehicle battery plant in Indiana will help recent Indiana Commerce Secretary Brad Chambers in his bid for governor. 31% of you say yes, 69% say no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR. And look for the poll. Well, a legal dispute between a teachers' union in Richmond and their school corporation may set an important precedent for how educator salaries are negotiated across the state. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Kirsten Adair reports the dispute is over the timing of supplemental payments added on top of base salaries.
The Richmond Community Schools Board recently set up temporary supplemental payments to teachers for this school year. Generally, districts can legally make such payments without union approval, yet the local teachers' association alleges the district is violating state labor law. It argues these payments should have come after legally required base salary negotiations. Jennifer Smith Margraf is vice president of the Indiana State Teachers Association.
Paying out stipends in advance to groups can affect how much money is left to put onto base wages. And that really matters.
If the State Education Labor Board rules the district did nothing wrong, it may open the door to more districts doing this and limiting union power to negotiate lasting salary increases.
Terry Austin, regardless of how the State Labor Board rules, which could take quite a while, how likely is it that the General Assembly steps into the middle of this?
Well, I never want to predict what the General Assembly will do.
You can't. Oh, come on.
But the truth is, it would not surprise me. It would be consistent with the philosophy of the majority that we treat teachers as free agents, an attempt to weaken or dismantle union negotiation power. Right now, they could only do wages and benefits. And the point is that if you take this money off the top, like they do with the voucher program and charter school funding, then there's less money down below to pay individual teachers. Teachers are not overwhelmingly, teachers love a bonus, but they don't like being pitted against one another. I can tell you that. Having spent 3 weeks in a classroom at the beginning of this school year, they want to work together as a team. And there's nothing worse for the culture of a school and a school environment than to have people negotiating behind everybody else's back and it also gives the opportunity for favoritism and, you know, less favorable results for everybody.
I'm not going to opine or ask anybody else to opine on whether or not this is actually legal. This is a core of the dispute. Is this allowed under Indiana's current rules? I'm not going to ask anybody to opine on that. We'll find out eventually whether or not it is, or if the General Assembly just decides to make their policy a little more clear. But to the points that Terry just raised, if you're a school administrator, bonuses are great. But are you running the risk of creating a more negative culture in your school by seemingly trying to pit teachers against each other?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, that's part of the downside of dismantling or the stated opposition to dismantling collective bargaining, because you do get them pick and choose who's getting what benefits and ancillary, you know, benefits as a teacher. But it's really curious to me what the impact of this will be, because the legislature, Governor Holcomb, Republicans and Democrats spent the last three budget cycles kind of agonizing over how do we make sure that this ever increasing share of the budget. And they increased by billions, and by as a percent, far more than we in the last two cycles, especially since we had all this extra money. They were always agonizing over, okay, well, we're appropriating this money, but we can't really figure out how to get it to the teacher. We've said as a matter of our goal or a matter of policy that we prefer that, but there was really no way to actually ensure that. Other than dismantling. Completely dismantling collective bargaining and taking over salaries at the state level was the extreme option. So it'll be interesting to see how they handle this, because now you're in a scenario where, okay, well, the stated goal was $50,000 for teachers. We gave a bunch of extra money. We're just letting you know, school district, that's our goal and our expectation. But now you have a scenario where these teachers, what if you don't have the money next year? Okay, well, now these teachers are making less than they made last year. Well, that wasn't the goal. It was never the goal for them to make less year over year. We struggled with what's the right floor and the minimum we can pay them. So I could see, I think the expectation was Republicans wouldn't touch us, but I think they'd have to. Yeah.
And in terms of talking about the ripple effect, this is the sort of main event is playing out in Richmond. A similar dispute is happening in Evansville. So this might start happening in more places. Does it need to get resolved at a state level?
It probably does, because this is going to come up again and again. And there's so many different philosophies sort of in combat here. Some are not wearing white hats and some are black. It's just a lot is at work here. For instance, the notion of rewarding performance and success is sort of at the core of education as a whole. That's why you have honor roll. That's why you have a grading system. That's why kids are named valedictorian, or why all state designation is awarded to certain athletes. So one could argue, why not give that same recognition and monetary reward to teachers who excel? And is it not logical, therefore, that the people who are most familiar with the performance of those teachers may be the people at the local level? That's one philosophy. The other problem is, do you run the risk of pitting one against another, as has been discussed here, and, as Terry Austin pointed out, favoritism, which these are not automatons that are on school boards or in superintendent's offices or HR offices or whatever mechanism is being used to divvy up these dollars. They're humans, and personal relationships come into it. And as sure as I sit here, there will be instances where it's awarded for the right reasons and those where it's awarded for the wrong reasons.
And even if it's not for the wrong reasons, it opens the door with people saying, accusing you of that.
Yeah.
So even if you really were looking at some sort of metric, which it's really hard to do in education, to just look at a raw metric as a determination of performance for a teacher, but even if you were just using that, it's way too easy for
but
a teacher
again,
to get
that,
it to say,
isn't
well,
that every,
you went to dinner at their house once, and so that's why you're
isn't that every teacher fellowship? Isn't that every scholarship
right.
for students?
Right.
Isn't it every attempt to get on a student recognition panel?
I think the answer could maybe be, it doesn't have to be either or. Why can't we have a middle ground here? Why can't we have a base level where everyone gets a good matrix, gets a minimum salary, gets regular raises, but then also reward teachers who are doing really well with bonuses? I mean, I think there can be sort of a middle ground. It's complicated a little because everyone can see it. I can go online and look at someone's, because they're public dollars, I can see what that
job.
Teacher is
yeah.
making versus I can't go see what my coworker is making in a private business.
Well, and again, the other complicating factor is the unions are legally allowed to negotiate very, very little anymore. Right. But the big thing they are allowed to negotiate are wages and benefits. And these fall outside of that. So again, if you are someone who believes in the power of a teacher's union to speak up for all of your teachers, it weakens the ability of that teacher's union to go, well, okay, maybe the system is a little unfair, but we can't do anything about it. So that the other middle ground might be making that part of the things you can negotiate. I'm not going to predict that from the General Assembly.
I think the General Assembly would be better off if they turned their attention and energy back to the teacher compensation
To Mike's point, they have been working.
They really need to do that.
All right. Three members of the Indiana General Assembly have announced this year they won't run for re-election or any other office in 2024, and all three are Republicans from suburbs of Indianapolis.
Avon Senator John Crane was the first to announce, saying he decided after considerable prayer and discernment to step away after 8 years in office. One of the longest-serving current lawmakers was next, Carmel Representative Jerry Torr, who's going to retire from political office after nearly three decades. And another Carmel representative, Donna Shibley, announced recently she'll also forego a re-election bid next year, saying only that serving in the House was a privilege.
John Schwanis, there aren't that many competitive state House districts left anymore. Are these three potentially on that list?
I think any time you look at Indianapolis and then you go out in the concentric circles, the next line out, that's where you're going to find the sort of change in terms of demographics. Keep in mind that if we were sitting here 20, 30, maybe 40 years ago at this table and talked about Marion County, it was like Orange County, California. It was, if you were Republican, you were going to be elected. I mean, with the exception of some districts, maybe at the council level or so forth. And now that's not the case. It's a Democratic bastion. And I think you're seeing change as the community grows, as education levels change, as just demographics. I mean, that nothing changes opinions like demographics. And I think because of Indianapolis's growth and its economic development, you're going to have some more wild cards. And those districts are not as ironclad or predictable as they would have been 20, 30 years ago.
Less so perhaps John Crane, who was a fairly conservative figure at the State House. But I think Jerry Torr and Donna Shibley were both fairly moderate Republicans, reflective of the districts they represented. At least in Donna Shibley's district, you have a lot of folks from the more further right side of the spectrum who have been looking at that seat regardless of whether Donna Shibley was going to run again or not. Is there a chance that it will be even more in play for Democrats if primaries swing to the right?
Yeah, I mean, I think this one will be fascinating because we've been talking about the demographic changes for a couple cycles, and now we're going to have some open competitive seats. Jerry Torst, you know, came close to losing last time, and that was a veteran lawmaker with roots in the community. And
again, you know, whose votes are generally reflective of
absolutely.
His
constituents. And so I think it's absolutely possible that Democrats could make some gains in there. And obviously the goal for Democrats is to break a supermajority somewhere. That would take
four seats. Yeah. Is that four seats flipped to do that? That's a tall order with the
absolutely
with the way the districts are drawn right now. How much will one of the hottest mayor's races in Indiana this year is going to be that Carmel mayor's race, where you have a legitimate Democratic candidate going in an open seat, which has not been true for three decades. How much will some of these local races this year tell us about what might be coming in those statehouse races next year?
Oh, I think a great deal. And people are watching these numbers. They're gonna dissect the numbers. It was surprising to me that they announced in October, which essentially shuts their fundraising down, which is a little bit of a surprise, quite honestly. But I think that, you've got strong candidates have already announced in two of those three seats.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe the handwriting was on the wall.
I think certainly in the case of Jerry Torr, it was.
Yeah.
Donna Shively took me a little bit more by surprise.
May not have been made totally on their own, but in consultation with other people, that it was time to step down. So I think these mayoral races are going to have a huge impact.
Democrats obviously very rarely have the resources to match Republicans in this state. It's just the reality of the political situation here in Indiana. But considering that there aren't a long list of competitive seats, you could potentially put a little more money into races in Carmel and Avon. And so are we going to see money spent in these places next year?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you've got to collect money statewide and prioritize it and direct it in places where you think you can make gains. I think in two of these, for Republicans, in these districts, the quality of the candidate matters, period. Like, if you are not going to win from the right in these communities, so you've got a guy like Brett Clark out in Hendricks County, where the John Crane seat is central, really popular sheriff, very well organized, ran great campaigns. He was the underdog when he ran for sheriff the first time and won by like 50 or 60 points.
The Indiana Sheriff's Association has been in
president.
Leadership
he's
that.
Got a great network there. And then Danny Lopez up in the Jerry Torr seat. Danny is no right winger. He is a perfect fit for that district. But that quality matters. You look in Zionsville, they elected a Democrat mayor 4 years ago.
Yes, they did. That's right. All right, traffic fatalities in Indiana are up 17% over the last 4 years. And while state lawmakers are digging into the data on traffic safety, a study committee adopted its yearly report this week without any recommendations.
Even as fatalities increase, the number of speeding tickets and warnings in Indiana went down 12% over the last 4 years. Indiana Criminal Justice Institute Executive Director Devin McDonald told lawmakers that's not because drivers are slowing down.
I would probably attribute that more to not enough law enforcement officers on the road to truly enforce traffic laws in the state of Indiana.
McDonald says police enforcement is the primary way to reduce speeding, though the state will soon begin to use speed cameras in a few highway work zones. Besides speed, McDonald says impaired driving is a major cause of crashes and deaths, and he says drug-impaired driving now exceeds alcohol-impaired driving.
All right, here we go. Nikki Kelly, are study committees still meaningful?
Look, there's always an exception to the rule, and I have seen an occasional study committee do some good work. But the fact is that the majority, no. They show up two to three times. They listen to a few people testify and give them some reports. They make no recommendations, and they collect their little per diem check. That's what they are.
I was talking to Representative Greg Stuhlwald for a piece I'm doing in the next couple of weeks about, you know, getting tough legislation across the finish line. And Stuhlwald told me, like, the reason that he gets a lot of tough bills across the finish line in a single session is because by the time he gets to session, he's done 8 months of work leading up to it. That's partly what these committees are supposed to be, is as we, you know, every lawmaker can't pay attention to every issue. They rely on their fellow lawmakers to tell them, okay, here's some information, here's what I've looked into. Now, just because a study committee doesn't have a recommendation doesn't mean they're not going to do something. But would it be more valuable with people's time and taxpayer dollars to actually say to fellow lawmakers, we've looked into this and here's what we think we should do when it comes time to actually passing laws?
Well, yeah, that's the ideal. I mean, these are set up for a purpose, and it's exactly what Representative Steuerwald talks about. You know, let's lay the groundwork. Let's get the input. Let's solicit. Let's hear all sides and try to cobble together something that's agreeable so it doesn't get torpedoed before, between Organization Day and the start of the form session in January. But the problem also is some people treat it, not everybody's Greg Steuerwald, and others treat them perhaps as a pressure valve or a way out during the session where you got a tough issue, but you want to appear to do something.
Yeah.
Let's do a study committee, interim study committee, because then we can say we did something.
Yeah.
We're studying it.
All right. That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Terry Austin, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwanis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Indiana Capital Chronicle. You can find Indiana Week in Review's podcast and episodes at wfyi.org/IWIR or on the PBS app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana's public broadcasting stations.